And so that's the Green New Deal perpetrated by, well, now the Biden administration and Bernie Sanders and AOC and all these socialists, they don't really understand. They probably just really believe that solar panels but you say that it's a big globalist idea to eugenics to lower the population because there just won't be enough juice to go around, as was proven in Texas 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Texas is a perfectly good case study of this.
Right.
That's correct. And people like AOC or Bernie Sanders, like they're human beings for the most part. They're not like Dr. Evils,
right? But they just don't know.
If you just came out saying like we need to lower the world population and that's why we have to cancel all of these big infrastructure projects that JFK was doing, and that's why we had to shut down investments into nuclear fusion power, which all got shut down in the late 60s, and that's why we had to cancel the space program when we shut down Apollo in 1973, and today the U.S. can't even put a human being back on the moon if they wanted to, because all of this was consciously they don't have the technology,
we don't have the juice to do
that's it? Why it was such a that's why it was such a big success when Donald Trump revived the manned space program, because it was totally shut down, so they had to rebuild and reconstruct those capacities that we once had decades ago. We self-sabotaged, and it took, a lot of time to start reconstructing that, to the point that we didn't have to go and ask Russia, please let us use your Soyuz spacecraft to put a human being into orbit anymore, because that's what we were doing for many years until Donald Trump finally revived the U.S. ability to launch human beings into orbit. But we still can't even like land a human being on the moon anymore. I mean, we shut down the rocketry. All of that.
Interesting. Let me interrupt. So what's going on now today with fascism that we can all relate to, our listeners around the world today, that is, I guess, building this whole energy towards more of these people that we've been talking about, not the who's, but the what's. So what do they want? And what do they want?
They want what Cecil Rhodes was talking about. They want to get rid of all sovereign nation states, the institution itself of sovereign nation states, which really only arose out of the European golden renaissance of the 15th century. That was before that there really wasn't nation states. There were some city states, but it was pretty much a world of empire. There was nothing other than empire and different types of empire ever. And so in the Renaissance, you had a new idea that natural law was the guide for economic and political law. So the concept that there's a divinity of the individual because we're made in the image of the creator, and because we're made in the image of the creator, because we could discover and ever improve upon our understanding of nature's creation, which involves our own minds too, where we are created by nature, but we're the only part of creation that can self-reflect and then willfully, through reason and conscience, change our modality of behavior in accordance with our discoveries for the good of both ourselves, our children, and the world around us, right? We can empathize with others and sacrifice for a greater good. So we have a concept of the soul, of the conscience.
Yes.
So all of these concepts together.
Wow.
Animated a movement politically that was then acted upon for the first time by King Louis the 11th in France. And it was defined around the idea that as a king, and you could read Louis the 11th's like Rosebush of War and his messages to his kids. There was a movement of Platonic humanists who arose around him, who basically had the understanding that if you are a king, you are not a king. That doesn't mean that you are the privileged minority to impose your will on your slaves. It means that you're a servant and an instrument of God's will, and you have a duty to the people who you serve to do good for them. And so the treasuries became redirected towards infrastructure building, the investment into increasingly engineering projects, the arts and culture, teaching orphans how to read, so mass education projects.
Wow. And which Louis was this? Which Louis was this, and what year?
Louis the 11th, in 1460 something.
Was he rare in his benevolent dictator king?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was a rare dude.
Yeah, he was quite rare. But there were co-thinkers who felt the same sort of thing as he did as a Christian king, and King Henry VII was a follower of his example and acted in England to replicate his principle of political economy. People like Thomas More, Erasmus, were organizers of Henry VII. Unfortunately, his son, Henry VIII, was more of a degenerate who was corrupted.
Yeah, you are. And, Henry. Yeah.
But Henry VII was a good guy. Yeah. And that was known as what's called cameralism. The political economy was, it had a name. It was called cameralism. Huh. And it was not empire. It was nothing else. And so this is what evolved out of the Renaissance, and it took on more form out of the 30 Years' War, where you had finally the Peace of Westphalia that was created by Cardinal Mazarin and Finance Minister Colbert in France, who organized all of the different warring factions of Protestants versus Catholics who had slaughtered themselves for decades, funded by Venetian and Dutch bankers who were just funding all sides to create a war of all against all forever. And half of Germany died. You know, throughout the 30 Years' War, half of Germany was wiped out. The Black Forest was razed to the ground. It was like, you can't even imagine how bad it was. And finally, the peace treaty that put an end to that conflict. And all sides, like I said, were being funded by the same bankers, the same oligarchs who were the same families. Wow. that are still in power today at the top of the pyramid. There's the same families that could trace their lineages back to like the days of the Roman Empire and Babylon. So Colbert and Mazarin organized, this time it was under Louis XIV, who was a bit of a lopsided king, sometimes did good, sometimes did bad. He soon became, anyway, he did his worst as a king under the influence of the Jesuits, which was a sort of Masonic counter-operation to try to create a new type of religious mercenary force that was beholden to the empire in 1534 under Ignatius Loyola. That's a whole other sideshow.
Yeah, yeah.
But these groups really influenced the king. But the point is that the Peace of Westphalia created the foundation for the modern sovereign nation state as we know it. So when Henry Kissinger comes out and he's given many speeches saying we have to create with the 9/11 attack in the USA, we have to now create the post-Westphalian era. When he says that, what he's referring to is the Westphalian principle, that time of 1648, which said, okay, we will now recognize that every nation has sovereign boundaries that have to be respected. But the key was the benefit of the other, that as of in that treaty, the first three principles of the preamble of that treaty involved every nation working for the benefit of their neighbor, on the basis also of the forgiveness of past transgressions. And these things were the key that made the thing work. And it was tied to infrastructure projects in France and Germany, that both sides would start funding canals, education projects, industry that would alleviate the burdens of life of the peasants and also create educational opportunities. So this was an explosive revolution in statecraft that then took on new form with the American Revolution. People like Alexander Hamilton, who studied Colbert, he studied, Ben Franklin also studied Colbertism, and they took it and amplified it when they created the system of national banking, protective tariffs, directed credit for big projects, industry. That was the American Revolution created a new system of political economy. And that's why Alexander Hamilton was assassinated by the founder of Wall Street, Aaron Burr, who was always beholden to the City of London intelligence. And that's why Aaron Burr, to avoid being arrested in 1808 because he was caught in a conspiracy to break up the Republic and put himself up as king of the North Western kingdom that was supposed to be created in the territories that hadn't become provinces yet, states yet. He was caught red-handed. Somebody blew the whistle, and he had to escape and avoid arrest by going to the house in London of Jeremy Bentham, where he lived for 5 years. That's Aaron Burr. Oh. With Jeremy Bentham, the head of British intelligence, for 5 years before being deployed back to the United States, where he then became the patron of Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren, who he set up, and he was the first earliest backer funded and controlled by British intelligence to put their populist puppet in power, who was a racist slave power puppet who cleansed the South of natives. And we've talked about this in your previous show.
But wasn't Andrew, though, didn't he run on the idea that he was going to get rid of the swampy bankers, the people that put him in? That was all a smokescreen.
Yeah, All he did, he basically, the sophistry there was that he, his job was to destroy the second Hamiltonian Bank of the USA, run by Nicholas Biddle. That was his job. When he said we're going to destroy the corrupt bankers, it was actually the state, the National Bank of the USA that he was designated to destroy. But what he did is he empowered all of the actual Wall Street banks, the private banks, and he basically gave every state bank the right to control their own credit. He destroyed a national currency. The idea of a national mission was all destroyed. He canceled all of the infrastructure projects that were being built up in the 1820s and 30s. He canceled all of it to pay the debt. So everything was just shut down. The nation was shut down, and it was deregulated and turned into a speculative frenzy, so that you had the bank panic of 1837. That was a giant bubble popping caused by his deregulation policies and free trade. And the nation was completely destroyed. And also the slave power, he gave them he cleansed all of the southern areas of the Cherokee natives and created the Trail of Tears that killed thousands of Cherokee,
yeah.
and gave all of the land that they had lived on over to the slave power to grow cotton for the British, who bought all the cotton. They were the primary purchaser of South cotton, which they then used in their textile industries because they and created a global monopoly. You know, meanwhile, India was forced to produce opium that they then fed to the Chinese to keep China down.
It's just like 180 degrees of what the people, yeah, I've believed about Andrew Jackson for years, right? I mean, then he was one of the good guys. He was like 1814, took a little trip down a mighty Mississippi, right? Matthew Arrett is with us. He's always fun. CanadianPatriot.org. So before we go, let's kind of dig in a bit to, I'd like to understand, Matthew, more about the globalist agenda now with this whole socialist idea of canceling student loans, which you know is going to happen, universal basic income, the Green New Deal, minimum wage, which is going. So the what of this is to just make, is it as simple as just to make people weaker by borrowing money from the private bankers to give to people, like what they're doing with this $2 trillion stimulus thing, right? Is this the idea behind it to make people weaker?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's designed to create a new feudalism. They've romanticized those who are controlling the Great Reset agenda, these billionaire technocrats who see themselves as sort of like above these ubermensch, right? These more than human Nietzschean freaks like Bill Gates and others. They see themselves, and these Rhodes Scholars, right? They're trained to see themselves in a very elitist way. They romanticize states of no change, and they think that states of uncontrollability, which are states of change, are bad because you don't control creativity. You know, like, so whenever whenever you have sovereign nation states working for the general good of the people and encouraging the development of new infrastructure, new technology, the development of the arts and culture for the people, there's a lot of mental activity, creative mental activity that tends to arise. And whenever that happens, you have new discoveries coming out of, you know, you have the creation of Einsteins and Max Planck's and Da Vinci's that tend to arise out of poor families that you're like, I didn't allow that to happen. And they're control freaks. So when they look at things like the feudal dark ages, where, you know, the population of Europe collapsed by like, you know, 50% or something, they romanticize that because in that world, they're like, okay, the slaves knew their place. There was, you know, 95% illiteracy, and that was good. People didn't, when they're ignorant, they didn't have greater ambition to change things or to think through causality. The slaves knew their role. The masters were happy in their castles. Now they've romanticized that because life wasn't even very good for the kings and masters living in castles who didn't have soap, you know, that wasn't, had no refrigeration. So ironically, you know, the oligarchy themselves rely themselves upon the benefits of technological discovery that's happening outside of their control. They hate the thing that causes creative discoveries, but they like the effects of it that they use for themselves. They're fine with that. So all that to say, it's an irony, a self-contradiction of empire. So what they want to do is create a sort of technocratic feudalism that crushes the idea of creative thought and change, and create sort of this permanent system of an end of history forever. The problem is Russia, China, and the nations working on the Belt and Road Initiative, which is otherwise known as the Multipolar Alliance or the New Silk Road.
They're not having
created
it. Yeah, they're not.
No, they're not having it. They're not accepting the depopulation. They're by by standing up, and you could see this at Davos at the conference in January of this year, Putin and Xi Jinping's speeches. You should read the whole thing.
I did. I heard Putin's speech, man. He was like, he was saying things like, Matthew, you guys are crazy. What are you doing here?
It's really strong. Making the case that sovereign nation states have to be preserved. That's the idea of multipolarity, that the whole of the world has to be defined around the respect for the individual liberty of each nation, mm-hmm. and that the purpose of economic activity and the behavior of money and investments has to be somehow tied to the real world that benefits human life. That's why you have these infrastructure projects that are pulling people out of poverty at rates that we've never seen before, coming out of that part of the world, not coming out of what we're doing. So that's what the empire wants to crush, because they know, the oligarchy knows, that to the degree that China and Russia continue to display a common sense, rational, moral principle of banking and economic activity, the more it will create an alternative in the minds of people like us and people who are in policymaking positions across the transatlantic zone to jump onto that as our system melts down. They don't want to have an alternative for us to jump onto.
Yeah. So has this been the whole thing behind the Russian election thing, and now the China virus, they call it, or whatever, and the whole China thing and the election fraud and all this stuff, which may or may not be true, China was involved, who knows. Is this what this is all about, to make these guys the bad guys so we don't think they're alternatives? China, Russia?
Yeah, like no country is perfect, and you got sure. problems. Yeah, you have deep state elements within China. I mean, look at the triads, right? Like the existence of the Chinese organized crime syndicates that are centered around Hong Kong, Macau, some areas of Guangdong province on the south east coast of China, and also Taiwan. But the triad structure, which is sort of like the mafia criminal syndicates, but they're very powerful, were created by British intelligence throughout the 19th century during the Opium Wars. That's when they created this organized system of crime, and it was very tied to British Freemasonic operations too, under Lord Palmerston. At the same time as they were doing this, when they were creating different, you know, organized crime networks in India, that would be self-controlling, so that, you know, you could have 20,000 British troops in India, which was a population of 400 million. But how does 20,000 troops control 400 million people? It's not by the physical force of the British troops. It's by creating an organized crime network using the Brahmins and the caste structures that are already there in India, that the British were able to profile, amplify, and all of the progressive Indian movements, like the Indian Congress, that wanted to get rid of the caste system. That's what they had to crush and put water on those fires, while putting gas on the more regressive fires, and they were creating zones of local control, and they did that with the United States. That's how the creation of the deep state, and they're all still to this very day controlled by British foreign intelligence operations to this very day. China has been trying to expel that and purge that now for a few decades, and there's been a lot of effort that's been made by Xi Jinping to try to get rid of this corruption from within the heart of China, and he's done quite an incredible job at that. Putin as well is dealing with the mayor of Moscow, with varieties of Russian oligarchs that were created largely in the 1990s under the you know, City of London directed shock therapy that raped Russia and privatized its state economy when the Soviet Union collapsed. So Putin basically had a meeting in 2000 with these various oligarchs, saying, okay, look, there's going to be a new set of rules here after Yeltsin, right? And he said, okay, either you are now going to abide by national policy and what we do. You can keep your money. I'll let you keep your money. But if you don't abide by the rules that Russia, that I'm going to put forth, we're going to take you down. And you had a lot of Russian oligarchs that resisted.
Yeah.
And he put them in prison, or if they did escape, they went to London, where they now have mansions in what's called Moscow on the Thames. People like Sergei Skripal were part of this traitor class. And so, you know, Russia is still dealing with some of these traitorous elements of billionaires who are more loyal to the City of London within his own civil service, that are very powerful to this very day, even though Russia is still on top of things. They're not, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah.
So
we have a couple emails here before we go for Matthew. Sure. One is from Sophia. She says, why is the Biden administration bombing Syria now? What is this about, in your opinion? the serious stuff. What is this involved with the Putin and the pipeline? Is that part of it?
No, not the Nord Stream pipeline directly, though they hate the Nord Stream pipeline.
Sure.
Absolutely. I mean, everything is sort of connected in that sense. But no, they're what you're going to see now with Biden coming in, like Trump, under Trump, there were no new wars. And Trump, despite the slanders against him, did a lot to resist the military industrial complex in a variety of ways over 4 years. Under Obama, the policy of the U.S. foreign policy, which was tied to the CIA, which Trump also disconnected the CIA from the Pentagon and this and the military in November of last year, they're reintegrating that once again. And the Obama policy was to use proxies, so fund through Saudi Arabia, through Turkey, and through on the ground CIA operations, including Integrity Initiative. Actually, if you look at these new data documents that were dumped, a lot of them go through how they're actually funding various rebel groups again in Syria, which are tied to ISIS and Al-Qaeda in a variety of ways. So they use these things to create mass destabilizations, and they just blame things on Iran. So the current attack on Syria, as well as there was a more recent attack by Israel on groups in Syria who are defending Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian sovereignty against ISIS. What are they saying? They're saying these are groups that we're attacking in Syria that are run by Iran, who apparently these groups run by Iran attacked U.S. Military contractors in Iraq a couple of weeks ago. And because these groups attacked a military installation in Iraq, we're now going to kill these Iranian proxies in Syria and bomb Syria. I mean, the whole thing is really just moving us. They want to bring back online the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad. They never gave up on that. And Trump worked very hard to realign American military interests with the Russians, who went into Syria in 2015 to stop a Libya debacle from happening, which did happen. And with 1/10 of the military budget, Vladimir Putin was able to wipe out most of ISIS's foundation of support and preserve the stability of Syria. They want to undo all of this and just bring back give Assad the Libya operation. So this is going to escalate. There's going to be a massive escalation of ISIS, and we're being told by the media already, you know, it's predictive programming that ISIS is reorganizing themselves. They have a new leader. So we're being prepared to accept this new ISIS, which is always about, again, destroying even more Iraq and ultimately Iran, which is a key area in the Belt and Road Initiative, stretching through the southern connection from China through Xinjiang, which is why Xinjiang is also being attacked so China's being attacked very much for all of the bad things it's doing to its Uyghur Muslim population in Xinjiang. I mean, and it has nothing to do with the Western concern for the well-being of Uyghurs. In fact, the life of Uyghurs, if you actually look beyond the slander and anecdotal evidence that has no bearing in reality, there is no genocide happening by the Chinese government against Muslims in Xinjiang. What you have is a doubling of the Uyghur population in the last 25 years, hundredfold increase of GDP and massive trade skills, investments into education, like it's crazy, an infrastructure like we've never seen of greening deserts of Xinjiang, southern province, as well as building many rail projects in schools all across China's west coast and into Iran, into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, creating situations of economic opportunity that then would stretch into Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, into Egypt, into Africa, as well as other branches into Europe, which would create a climate of hope and opportunity. And that's what the empire is afraid of.
Wow.
And that's why they want to just create this mass instability in that entire zone and inflame Wahhabism, the most radical interpretation of the Quran possible, which is Saudi funded, British funded. And it's basically kill anybody who doesn't have our specific interpretation of the Quran, including other Muslims who might not think the way we do. That this is entirely a British operation.
Fascinating. So
that's what Biden is.
This is from George. I'm really enjoying the show. Thanks for having Matthew on. Have him back on more often. We will. I'd like to know how the Vatican fits into all of this, because I've read a lot about the Vatican, he says, and they sound like pretty swampy to me. George says they're swampy. Is the Vatican swampy?
Yeah, I mean, the Vatican has is a place, just like any institution of power and influence in modern times or the last 500 years. It's a place, or even longer, it's a place where there's been a lot of evil and a place where there's been good, a lot of good. And it all depends on the times. You know, it's just like the institution of the USA.
Sure.
There's times when it's been more infiltrated and less infiltrated. There's been times where humanists and patriots in command of their conscience were in a driving seat position, and other times where they were taken out. And there's popes who have been killed, poisoned by Jesuits over the years, many years.
Ooh.
I mean, there's many cases. There's cases of popes in the 1890s who expelled who basically went on a war against different Scottish Rite Freemasonic operations and infiltration. They spoke eloquently against this. There's a pope that excommunicated all the Jesuits as well in the 18th century, who also died mysteriously of probably, you know, food poisoning, oyster poisoning, like Warren Harding. So you have a battle historically. When you look at the Vatican, you have to look at it as a battle between good and evil within.
Uh-huh.
I think in more recent years, I've tended to like John Paul II. I think overall there was a reason why they tried to assassinate him in the 1980s. He generally was somebody who I identified as being a lover of humanity. He did a lot of
good guy.
A good guy. Benedict, I think, was a mixed bag who compromised way too much with the pedophile problem of the church, and looked another way. But you know, in the 1990s, when he was still cardinal, I got a book with a bunch of speeches, and you know, he came out attacking the New World Order quite a bit, and I was surprised to read all that.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, Pope Francis, this is the first time, I think, ever in history that you've had a living pope step down in favor of another pope being brought in.
Yes.
And the fact that Pope Francis, the Jesuit, is a very high-level Jesuit, indicates to me, with his policies promoting the Paris Climate Accords,
yes,
the greening of Christianity, like creating a new ethic that removes the idea that there's anything divine or special about humankind that is there in the Bible. He's basically trying to say, no, it's actually not really that, and trying to rewire the wording so that we get rid of the idea that there's anything special about us. And it's really just about reducing our impact on nature. That's the point of being a good Christian. I think that there's a satanic impulse and intention embedded within that takeover of the church currently. But there are still good cardinals. There's good people
within
the Vatican fighting against this. So I always encourage people to take that nuanced approach to appreciate the internal dynamics and power battles within anything that they're commenting on, because there's so much out there, like the Ring trilogy that I've seen and other things, which try to paint these very narrow, all black, all white judgments onto these institutions, which blind you from any insights you could get on a real historical study.
Is the Vatican is loaded monetarily with lots of money, as people say? I mean, have they really got a bunch of money stacked away? Any ideas?
It's less about the money itself and more about the rules defining money's behavior. And that's the city of London, which really has
rules
the top defining down
money behavior.
On,
what do you mean by that? Rules behind money's behavior.
Defining the behavior of the money monetary system. So it's less of accumulation of capital and more about how capital behaves that's more important. So the Vatican doesn't determine globally the behavior of the capital. They have a vast accumulation of capital, whereas you have to look at things like the City of London, where you look at who are those controlling the operating system, defining the rules, the definitions of the behavior of the entire system of how money will circulate, move, behave, be defined, how our minds relate to this thing called money. That's more important. So in that sense, the City of London is much more in the driver's seat.
I see. Finally, so what is your take on this whole vaccine thing? It's not even a vaccine. Technically, legally, we've been shown very clearly that these are injectable medical devices. They're not vaccines. They're not classified as vaccines these things, according to the people that we've talked to in the research, they're very, very dangerous. But it seems like there are huge forces behind, through all the media, of course, to get vaccinated. Of course, then the Gates thing. What is this all about, in your opinion, with this vaccine thing for COVID? Now there's going to be one and two, and you got to get three. Is it all eugenics, lowering the population, Matthew, in your opinion? Let's just kill more people? Is it that simple?
I don't know enough to speak too deeply, but what I can say is that, like, I was just reading about how the Russian Sputnik V vaccine actually uses conventional, historic, you know, use a little particle of dead virus.
Is that right?
The typical way. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I didn't know that.
It's very different from the RNA manipulation thing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're actually using the conventional idea. And in that sense, I'm persuaded that going back to the 18th century, the days of smallpox, like the human body is a regenerative creation. And like if you put like a small particle of something, which is the whole idea of vaccinations originally, we could develop antibodies and become immune. Okay, fine. But under the last 35 plus year big pharma takeover, especially the scientific takeover of big science and especially medical science, and also looking at the carryover of a lot of these major eugenics organizations of the 1930s and 40s, like the Sterilization Society for Human Betterment, which became Engender Health, a multi-billion-dollar megalith that's tied to Gavi, and it's tied to Oxford's AstraZeneca vaccine developments of mRNA vaccines, or also the Galton Institute, which is also enmeshed in this Gates operation with the World Health Organization and is developing the AstraZeneca. The Galton Institute was the British Eugenics Society that Julian Huxley ran, while he created the World Wildlife Fund. That was funding Hitler's eugenics policies. So I'm not comfortable when I look at those connections. And then I look at how Eric Lander, the current science czar of the United States under Biden, formerly it was John Holdren who ran Obama's science policy. And now it's Lander bringing back the Holdren policy. Lander is a Rhodes Scholar, and he was the guy who's just a mathematician. He looks at the world from a mathematical lens, that it's all just balancing equations, and he looks at life that way too. When he was the head of the Human Genome Project, he was the head of that, and the Human Genome Project maybe unlocked a few interesting things about human DNA, but if you look at the misuse of this through things like CRISPR, I think CRISPR is a technology that involves gene manipulation and stuff, which it could be. I'm open to the possibility of this being used for the good, to get rid of hereditary diseases like sickle cell anemia there's so many big diseases. I'm a technological optimist, so I'm not going to just sit there and say these are things we just always have to live with and there's no cure. I believe that anything, including GMOs, could be feasibly used for the good of humankind, but you can't, if you have an evil, satanic, oligarchical system defining the political structure and economic structure in which these things are operating, I'm not comfortable with that at all.
Yeah.
And the fact that all of these guys are really, really obsessed with depopulation and things like that,
they really are.
I don't trust it.
Yeah, really. Hollywood, Hollywood is going bonkers over Governor Abbott opening up Texas. I don't know if you've seen some of the people out there. These guys.
No, I didn't see it.
Oh,
no.
I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, and that ties into the media. I mean, we know that there's a very few people pulling all the strings in virtually all the media, from the New York Times down to local TV stations. Mm-hmm. Do you see that ever changing at all, Matthew Earhart? Ever getting any, I mean, I've been in broadcasting for 50 years, over 50 years. I've never seen anything so bonkers as this. Never.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I don't know. I mean, I like the science thing, like entertainment and science. It's all about do you live in a system, a political economic system defined by the oligarchical principle of the few managing the many for the benefit of a master class? Or do you live in a society that acts upon the reality of the sacredness of human life, as I see is an increasingly dominant quality of what defines the behavior of the multipolar alliance around the Russia-China cooperation agenda. If you live in that type of system, and we've seen examples where, I mean, look at times when America was more moral, not never perfect, but more moral, more accessing of its humanity and basic fundamental human virtues.
Yeah.
You were able to produce, like, look at Frank Capra's movies,
of
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and a lot of these great edifying movies like The State of the Union with Spencer Tracy in 1949, or Judgment at Nuremberg, or there's many movies that had the effect of edifying, enriching, and creating better citizens for have with insight into reality than a lot of the movies that are designed to have the opposite effect in our more modern age. And there's you know, China is not very good. They're learning. They're not good at subtlety and drama. Like they're overcoming a lot of their I think their decades of communist art experience, which is very literalistic and like, you know, propaganda-esque. So they're learning, you know, they're shaking it off. But some of the movies that I've seen coming out of China, like Wandering Earth, is an interesting one where it's like, you know, it's a great example of a major production, multi-million dollar production. Very entertaining to watch. The acting, like I said, is very, man, they got a ways to go. But the principle of like the Earth is encountering. Have you heard of this, the Wandering Earth movie?
No, I've got to watch that. The Wandering Earth?
Yeah, Google it. Wandering Earth. You might have to pay a few bucks for it online.
That's
but
all right.
It's,
I'll check it out.
The sun is going supernova, the people of the Earth have to get their shit together and learn how to work together to figure out how do you get the Earth into another orbit in.
Oh, cool.
Alpha Centauri, you know, that's going to be a 3,000-year project of developing techniques and technologies to get us out of our orbit before the sun goes supernova. And we're 20 years into this transit where now the Earth is moving around Venus, where it has to like do a little bit of a boomerang around Venus to get the momentum to get out of our solar system. But Venus is doing some weird things where its gravitational field is all of a sudden way stronger than they calculated, and it's sucking the Earth
into
Venus.
I want to watch that.
And they all have to figure out how do you get out of that. And the whole thing has a real spiritually edifying quality of making you love humankind a lot more.
Yeah.
So I think that sort of thing can be done in an entertaining, high value way.
Sure.
But yeah, to the degree that you have depopulation,
everywhere now. I mean, they sneak it in too, as you know. I watched a movie maybe 3-4 weeks ago, and it was pretty good. It was about I think it was Clooney, who's a total socialist. I mean, he's just crazy. But you know, the movie was pretty good. But at the very end, the whole reason why they were flying around in space looking for another place was we didn't pay attention to global warming. You know, they just threw that in at the end, right? This is the reason why the whole movie was taking place. They waited till the end. Yeah. Oh, we killed each other because, you know, and they do it, boy, all the time. Yeah. And they sneak this stuff in there. Even things like, you know, Aaron Sorkin, who's one of my favorite writers. I mean, he's really good, but he's total socialist. I mean, you know, you watch even things like The West Wing, and boy, I tell you what, you know, they got it in there all the time, whatever their little political agenda thing in there, you know, whether it be pro-abortion or whatever, they got it in there. And, well, I don't know. You must have to take...
Suits as well. They do this a lot.
You must have to take the blue pill just to become a movie star these days, right?
Or else you get canceled, right? And I mean, I like Matthew McConaughey.
He's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty...
Yeah,
he's a moral guy. I've seen him on Jordan Peterson, and he's a human being with substance who's more of a conservative minded guy. He accesses his morality, and he picks his parts based upon a certain moral principle. He doesn't just take whatever. Matt Damon tends to do the same thing too. So you got these good people. Mel Gibson as well, but
pretty
Mel
cool.
Kind of
John Voight is a good one. John Voight,
right? Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. James Woods.
Yeah.
What's the guy's James Woods?
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, you know, they write in. I see every now and then. I see a little thing from them on Twitter or something that somebody will post, and you know they have a hard time getting work though. You know, boy, they don't like you over out there in wacky land. And you know what, Matthew, interesting, being a screenwriter as I am. I mean, if you look at Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, man, they're all over too. Man, these globalist socialists are right in there, boy. Real, real deep already. Very, very deep. You look at any of the documentaries on Amazon or Netflix, they all got a socialist, liberal globalist agenda to them. Every one of them. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that
it's terrible.
Yeah, Netflix is a complete social engineering operation. It's a really effective way to control the zeitgeist. There is one thing, though. I would say anybody who wants to watch something entertaining, but you don't want to binge watch something that's going to make you a worse person, you know, because it's hard to find things like that. You don't want to waste your time on that. But I really would recommend. There's this very nonlinear. You wouldn't expect me to say this, but I watched hundreds of hours of this show, which is actually on Netflix.
Yeah.
called Ertugrul, and it's a Turkish
what's the name of it?
Drama. Ertugrul.
Can you spell it?
Ertugrul. It's got five seasons. Each season is massive. Ertugrul.
And it's in the subtitles, Ertugrul?
Yeah, it's in subtitles. And the story is, it has all of the makings of a proper classical tragedy drama, but with characters that have more substance than I've ever seen in a film, with a general plot line that actually gives you insight. It all takes place around the end of the 13th century, featuring the quasi-mythological father of the founder of the Ottoman Empire. There's a lot of, like, you know, creative writing of history, and I don't know if the actual founder of the Ottoman Empire, Osman, was actually all that good, but all that to say, what the writers do in this gives you more insight into how political operations actually work, how conspiracies work, how do you navigate through conspiracies with wisdom, and transformation. How do bad people get transformed to become good people? How do good people get corrupted into? And I mean, it takes more of the spectrum of human nature into consideration, as well as political dynamics into consideration, than I've ever seen anything do. So I would recommend people, even though it starts a bit slow, push on.
Yeah, push.
Watch the first season. It's it doesn't get stale, and there's a lot of it. There's hundreds of episodes.
Ertugrul,
but it's worth it. Ertugrul.
Ertugrul.
I gotta write it down. Ertugrul. There you go.
And it probably got through Netflix because they didn't look at the subtitles, right? They didn't figure out what was going on.
I guess not. It's weird. But yeah, that's the one thing that I found on Netflix that wasn't shit.
Well, Matthew, it's a pleasure. Yeah, we had a good time today. Thanks for coming on. It's always fun to have you here. Tell folks about, one thing, you know, I keep saying finally, before you go, give folks just a few ideas in short thing, because I got to move on and I have an appointment, about some things that they can start to think about and do to protect themselves and to have a better life with everything that you've talked about the last 2 hours. You know, there's a lot of, you know, what are some ideas that you have? I mean, that if you had a child, do you have a child?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
Say, but if you had a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old, what would you be telling them to do now?
Well, I would sincerely be looking into homeschooling and how to do that. Yeah. that would be a high priority for me.
Yeah.
But I think that I created an organization with my wife Cynthia called the Rising Tide Foundation.
Rising Tide.
To focus on education. Yeah, it's called RisingTideFoundation.net.
Okay.
So anybody can go to RisingTideFoundation.net, and what we're trying to do is to create a foundation for a proper classical humanist education with a focus upon understanding the best of different cultures of the world and history, with a focus also on science. We do lectures every week. We have reading groups set up, study groups. And what we're trying to do is look at, well, what were the types of educational processes in place throughout history that the empire worked to corrupt, destroy, because it awakens, there's certain methods of thinking about thinking, what's called epistemology, the science of knowledge, right? How do you come to knowledge? What are the pathways of the mind? And when people become aware, self-aware of what actions their mind does when it organizes itself to look for paradoxes, instead of just trying to memorize things and fit data into the mind, look instead for the questions that lead to paradoxes, that lead to better questions, that lead to generating solution concepts to paradoxes that allow you a resolution. This is what Plato does. So I suggest people really study the works, the dialogues of Plato. I couldn't emphasize that more. Read them, reread them, discuss them in a group, socialize that process, because he's teaching you the art of asking fruitful questions and becoming self-aware of thoughts you thought you knew, but upon poking around, you discover that they're wind eggs. They're actually not potent ideas. You don't measure up to reality. And then you could start thinking about where else do these qualities of thinking arise in other writers, as you incorporate and internalize that into your own mode of teaching. And I think people have to think of themselves as students and teachers for their children, to be role models for their fellow citizens, and to it's contagious, you know, because when you start demonstrating that there, you asked me earlier on, like, how do I keep all this information in my head?
Yeah.
I didn't really think about it too much, but I guess it was through really saturating myself, turning off the TV, everything else, social media, just don't go on that for a long time.
Yeah.
And just immerse yourself in Plato, in the writings of certain key figures that we have on our Rising Tide website. If you go down to the Library of Alexandria section at the bottom of our website, there's original writings of hundreds of key, beautiful thinkers in history that you can just read and internalize their process of thinking. You discover that there's something constant amongst all of their minds.
That's great. Yeah.
So I that's what I would encourage people to do right now. I've been on proper education by people like, you know, Julian Huxley, who ran UNESCO and reorganized the worldwide education that many people growing up in the 1950s, 60s, 70s were all victims to these reforms that took out the study of the classics. That's, you know, we used to learn about Greek language, Latin, so we could enrich our minds with new languages and be able to read original writings of the Bible or Homer or Plato in their original works. These were all called dead white European males and obsolete. So we were told not to do that. They're not practical. And instead to focus on, you know, memorizing mathematical formulas instead of understanding constructive geometry and astronomy, which used to be the focus. No longer were we told to, like, actually think through why did Pythagoras discover his formula of the Pythagorean theorem using physical geometry. He didn't have a formula to play with. He had to use circles, and he had to use, you know, divisions of circles to figure out, well, why would a squared plus b squared equal c squared physically in the universe? And then after discovering the Eureka, he could then label symbols on it and call it a formula that we could use. But to just memorize the formula like we were all told to do without being told why it's true, this only creates lower robots to fit into cogs of a machine.
Yeah.
So this is something we all have to sort of undo our conditioning and then access a more natural way of thinking by replicating real discoveries. So, and also the writings of LaRouche. I would say for people who really wanted to dig into this, there's a recently deceased American economist. He died at the age of 96 last year, named Lyndon LaRouche.
Lyndon, boy, he's cool. Yeah, cool guy, man.
He's very cool. Yeah. Very cool guy. And we're actually, our study group is just beginning to read some of his writings, The Science of a Christian Economy, that he wrote while he was in prison as a political prisoner in Virginia in the early 90s. And that's a whole interesting story because Robert Mueller, the guy who was assigned to destroy Trump, was the guy who was also designed at that time in the 80s to destroy LaRouche's organization when it was becoming a little bit too influential for the likings of Kissinger. And LaRouche's writings are especially his older writings from the 80s and the 90s, which is what we're going to be reading as our Rising Tide group. They're so rich with epistemological density. I really highly recommend people Google LaRouche or go to the Rising Tide website and look on the alphabetical ordering of the Library of Alexandria, which is at the very bottom of our website. There's every thinker is in alphabetical order. Go to the L section, and we have many of the key writings, books, and stuff available for free online. Read that and use it. Yeah,
Rising Tide. That's what I'll say. Yeah, risingtidefoundation.net. Right. I kind of like, I'm kind of addicted to courtroom dramas and the whole Socratic method, you know, of asking questions and all of that. That's pretty cool. And, you know, screenwriting, there's a lot of deep work that goes back to Aristotle and the way he constructed a story and drama, you know, Aristotle with pretty cool stuff too.
Aristotle, actually, one of the things that I recently, I came to discover this when I was originally waking up to the New World Order and trying to figure out how does this empire organize itself. And a few years into this process, I had read a writing by LaRouche that I'll email it to you and you can share it maybe with your audience.
I would.
Called The Secrets Known Only to the Inner Elites, which has a picture on the cover. It's from 1977 of Plato versus Aristotle from the School of Athens by Raphael. And in it, he basically goes through how Aristotle was a geopolitical creation by the empire to undermine and destroy Plato's academy from within. He actually was not Plato's student, but created a mode of thinking that was a direct attack on what Plato was doing in his dialogues, and was tied to high cultish networks from the Oracle of Delphi and the Peripatetic School. It's a whole interesting dialogue, and maybe we could have a whole discussion around that in a future interview.
Probably could.
But I'll send you this paper.
I'd like to see it.
Really interesting. Yeah.
All right, kiddo. Thanks a lot. So is your wife a geeky historian as you are? I mean, is she
Super geeky, man.
You got it.
Yeah. Cynthia Cheung, well, she writes for the Strategic Culture Foundation, which I also write for. Her work is just incredible on history and geopolitics. And they could see a lot of her works both on the Canadian Patriot website and also on the Rise and Tide website with her lectures and her classes that are on there too.
Wow. Well, I'm sure you guys have fun over there. And thanks for being on the show. Yeah. 2 hours. Great, Matthew. We appreciate it. You coming on the show. It's an honor, sir. And we'll keep in touch. Let us know if we can help.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on as always.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Matthew Arrett, CanadianPatriot.org and RisingTideFoundation.net. We'll put all these links on our show page. It's fun. I've been talking to a fellow like that. It really, you know, it's just more fun than going on Facebook, I tell you what, and arguing about left and right. All right, kids. Well, I will see you. When am I going to see you? Tomorrow. Jean Berlando. This is a very unique fellow. We are all unique, but he's really pretty cool. He's going to be here tomorrow at 10 o'clock. He's up in the northwest part of California. He's into regenerative farming, but also Chinese medicine and all kinds of things. It's a good man. He's going to be here tomorrow, Thursday. Hope you enjoyed the show today as much as I did. Thanks for your ongoing support. And we will see you tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And then on Friday, well, we'll have 2 or 3 hours of just Patrick and you. And we talk about all things kind of soul, mind, body, spiritual stuff. And I think we'll have plenty to talk about on Friday. So I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support. Really appreciate it. It means a lot to us, all the great emails we get and you supporting us by looking at our products and stuff. So take care. I love you. May the blessings be.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.